Chapter 13 of Hebrews. Those who are familiar with my regular preaching will know normally there are 3 points. I'm predictable in that way. And in this regard, I am equally predictable because there are 3 points. The first point is, don't disown your own. And the second point is, don't disown your own. And the third point is, don't disown your own. Don't disown your own is therefore the title. No surprises at all. We're looking particularly in chapter 12. Don't put 12. Thank you for pointing that out. I mean 13. There's nothing going on in my life at the moment that should distract me. We're in chapter 13. And it's a thing, isn't it, to try and address ourselves to a long, complex, and important chapter like this. But let me just begin with an illustration, if I may. This is going back, I think, to about 2005, 2006, or something like that. And I'd gone to the Aberystwyth Conference, which is a big Christian conference in the west of Wales. And we were thinking and talking a lot about evangelism. And that particular year, I had to drive back through a little town called Llanidloes, which was near where I was living at the time. And in Llanidloes, there's a little town square, centre bit, and there's a stone. And on that stone, 250 years, I can't remember if it's 200 years, I can't remember what it was, but John Wesley, as he'd gone through Llanidloes, had got off his horse and got onto this stone, and it said in his diary entry, "And I offered them Christ." So he'd gone into the town and he preached off this stone. And I'd come back fired up from the conference. And I thought, I'm going through Llanidloes. And it was the anniversary of this event. So next thing I knew, I was standing on this stone, offering them Christ. And to my astonishment, because it doesn't work very well these days, a number of people were stopping and listening, which was encouraging. And then the really extraordinary thing was this, that I saw this man walking across the street. He was with his partner and she was pushing a pushchair. And the next thing I knew, he was running towards me. And I was flying through the air, having jumped off this stone. I'm not suggesting that things happen to me and I'm totally not an active participant in this, as if stuff just happens. But I was jumping off this stone and throwing my arms around this guy as he threw his arms around me. And if you're listening, Andy Joynson, it was a friend of mine who I hadn't seen for about 15 years. And he and I used to knock around together and get into all sorts of trouble and scrapes in North London where I grew up. And I was converted and I became a Christian. And at that point, I remember going, sitting down and visiting him. He was sitting in the pub. I went to go and talk to him in the pub, and we sat down together, and I was offering him Christ. And he said, "Ben, if this is the path you've chosen, I'm out. I don't want to see you again." And that was the last time I'd seen him. And the next time I saw him, I was offering Christ on this stone in Llanidloes, and he'd moved there, and I'd moved there. And God's providence moved us together to that particular moment. And all the people who had been preaching to were gathered. We'd forgotten all about them. And they saw these two men sort of hugging in the street, like long lost brothers. And that's how it felt. And although he hasn't come to Christ, I'm still waiting, Andy, if you're listening, because I know sometimes he listens to my sermons. It goes online. We have not gone back to that place of him not wanting. We're good friends now. It's restored our friendship. And there are people in the crowd. And when we see a person in the crowd, maybe you've been to the airport or an unlikely place and you've seen a member of your family you didn't expect to see there, or a long-lost friend. And it's just, your heart just leaps. You just see somebody and you recognize somebody. And maybe it's somebody you work with and the last place on earth you expect to bump into them, and there they are. And your heart just leaps and you just recognize that person just stands out. It's like they've got an aura around them that singles them out. There's something special about that person at that moment to you. It's a great experience. Perhaps you spent time on your own for a length of time and you just see another human being. And if that same person was in a crowd, you wouldn't give them any attention at all. But because you've been on your own and suddenly there's another human being and suddenly there's a sort of an aura around them and you just go, how precious it is, how these some people are precious, aren't they? We afford such people a very special place in our experience. What I'm talking about here is the particular status, the particular concern, the particular love that we have for certain people. And I think this passage addresses itself to it. I'm going to be really focusing on verse 1. Let brotherly love continue. Brotherly, a special love, a very particular love that singles some people out from others and lavishes a sort of affection on them, a commitment to support and helping them, a desire to recognize and acknowledge them. I was watching, I hope you don't mind me saying, Philip and Mikhail, you two, when you're sitting there at the back as brothers, you had arms around each other's shoulders there, you know? Your brothers, and it's a precious thing to have a sibling, isn't it? To have a brother or a sister, somebody who you've grown up with. And we love it with our little kids when they show affection for each other. That's a precious thing, isn't it? When you see your children showing affection for each other, caring for each other, looking out for each other. It's important, isn't it? And here in this passage, we're called to focus on brotherly love. Let brotherly love continue. In the Roman world, because obviously this was written in the Roman era, everything was very, very, society was very organized in a way in terms of what your duties were to various different people. If you were a Roman citizen, you had a duty to support and help your fellow Romans. Friends, Roman, countrymen, lend me your... I know that was Shakespeare, but it gets the sense of it, doesn't it? This whole idea that you had a duty to each other. And the Roman society, Rome was split into two groups. There were those who were the Latini, the people who were born and bred, the old Roman families, and then those, the externi, those who had become citizens, like the Apostle Paul became a citizen of Rome, didn't he? And even though there were differences, you had a particular responsibility to your own, but there were other people who had become Romans, and now you shared this bond, this duty to each other, to help and support. And then outside were the foreigners. And some of them were your allies, and depending on how close an ally they were, it would shape your duties towards them. Then there were those who were the barbarians, mostly to be a bit suspicious of. You had to be a bit careful of the barbarians, maybe try and educate them, maybe try and bring them round. And then there were some people who were just the outright hostile enemies of Rome, and your duty was to resist them and fight them. You helped your friends and you resisted your enemies. That was your solemn duty as a Roman citizen. So I suppose the point is, when you saw a fellow Roman, you had this recognition. You had to recognize that person. You saluted that person. It was your responsibility not to be ashamed of your fellow Romans and to conduct yourself in a way that your fellow Romans would have no cause to be ashamed of you. This is the kind of the culture, I suppose, that this passage of Scripture was written in a culture like that. Closeness, a brotherhood, a sense of being fellow countrymen, of having this thing in common. And this was also effective in the families. The Roman family was organized in a very particular way. Have you heard the expression, the patra familias? The patra familias, the head of the family, the father of the house. And the paterfamilias had a legal responsibility. Every single person in that man's family, all the way down, whether it was younger brothers and siblings and their families and children, everybody, he was legally responsible for them all. And they were legally accountable to him. That was the structure of the Roman family. And anybody who wasn't in one of those families, because there were these various different big families
with the paterfamilias. Between these different families, there was a bond and duty that stood between them. The filius is the Latin term. This responsibility, although I'm not legally responsible for you and you're not legally responsible for you, I, as a fellow Roman, as a Roman family, we have this duty of care towards one another, to salute each other, to be affectionate towards another, to support and help one another. Woe betide you if you were a slave. The slaves were allowed no family, were not given permission to even have personhood. They were not people, they were property. Their families were property, and so outside of that, there was nobody had any duty or responsibility towards them whatsoever. And so, depending on who you were in relationship to who, depending on how much duty you felt towards them, to love, to support, to show affection. Why am I saying all this? Chapter 13, verse 1. It's a radical verse. It's a radical verse, and it's not a verse that stands alone. It stands within a whole network of verses throughout the New Testament that call for this brotherly love to exist between Christians. And this brotherly love is not one family to another or one citizen of Rome against another citizen of Rome. This family, this brotherly love is to continue. And clearly in amongst these people, who these Christians who the book is written to, they were loving each other already. But some sort of crisis had come up where that love was under threat. And the letter is written to strengthen and encourage and exhort them to continue in brotherly love. And this love, however, this love was to be afforded not on the basis of your actual citizenship. Did you pick it up in the verse? No abiding city, but our citizenship above. But on the single basis that you are a Christian. It doesn't matter whether you're a slave if you're a Christian. It doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman if you're a Christian. It doesn't matter if you're rich or you're poor if you're a Christian. Whether you're a Roman or a barbarian, if you're a Christian, your duty is to love each other, to support each other, to recognize and acknowledge each other, to show affection towards one another and help each other on the way. And so this verse crosses over all those boundaries, all those regimens of family and citizenship. It cuts across all of those things and unites a people who are not a people and makes them a people. Citizens of heaven. The citizens of heaven. It's a radical verse because suddenly the slave who is a Christian and the slave and the master who is a Christian, they must acknowledge one another. They must respect one another. They must care for one another. They must help one another and work together for the glory of God. It's turning the world upside down. The phrase here in the Greek, brotherly love, is Philadelphia, from which, of course, we get the name of the city in the United States. But it was a common name for cities in the ancient world, in the Greek world. Right across Asia Minor, there were cities by the name of Philadelphia. In fact, one of them, there's a church which was based there. We read about it in the book of Revelations, Philadelphia. It means brotherly love, Philadelphia. Because even the Greeks understood that if you were going to amass a group of people together and start a city and populate it with people, if people don't work together, if people don't support one another, if people are not affectionate and kind and gracious to each other, the city is not going to prosper. There has to be trust. There has to be good faith. Otherwise, the city will not prosper. And they understood that a real city, the prosperity, is founded on this Philadelphia, on this brotherly love existing, this sense of citizenship and mutual responsibility towards one another. Something bigger than me. Something bigger than you. Something must unite us, maybe just the citizenship of a little city, which will be there for a season and then pass away. But the Bible is talking about something far, far greater than that. The people of God, the city of God, which endures forever and ever. He's not talking about Rome here, is he? He's not talking about the Jerusalem that was there on the hill at that particular time and is still there to this day. He's talking about something far more glorious. the city of God. Literally speaking, he's saying that like a fellow countryman, like meeting when you go abroad and you meet somebody, you meet a Brit abroad. And there's something about that experience, isn't there? Or, as I said, a colleague, somebody who you work with, that brotherliness, somebody you work with, somebody who you share land with, somebody you share culture with, somebody you share background with, a relative. They're like, he's saying, treat each other as relatives, as if you were each other's relatives. Now, maybe some of you have got bad experience with relatives. That's not the point. The people of faith. And the whole point about the book of Hebrews, again and again, and if you're taking nothing away from this series we've been doing in the book of Hebrews, it's this. The title I gave for the series, Phenomenal Religion, is the way that the church is to be very visible. And this love, this affection, this support that is being offered between people should be visible. People should be able to see it. It should be evident to everybody. How will they know that you are my disciples, said Jesus? That you love one another. Evidently, openly, clearly. How will they know? There must be some proof. There must be something they can see. And that's the church. The visible evidence. You know, imagine if a person, they say, I'm not sure if they're a Christian. Somebody you've known, perhaps even comes to church. You're not sure if they're a Christian. Because somehow, some way, as yet, the evidence, the sign, the proof of it is not there. And in the same way, I think the love of each other, the love of the brethren, the love in the fellowship should be as evident and clear. Literally speaking, it's so phila, Philadelphia. Phila is the love element. Adelphos is the brethren element. And literally it means you have been cut from the same womb. You've come from the same womb, cut from the same quarry. You have the same parents. And if you're born again today, your father is Almighty God. And you are his children. He is your paterfamilias and no other. All of us, we are brothers and sisters. We are brothers and sisters. We have this common patron. One womb, one father, one God. In one sense, the word brotherly is used so often throughout this passage and others like it as applied to not just to the men loving each other, but to Christians in general, that it must be reasonable to translate this as sibling-like love. Brothers and sisters. This is not just amongst men. But I do say this, that men are more liable. Let's see if there's a mood in the room to agree with this. Men are more liable to egotism, self-centered, self-seeking competition, perhaps, than the women of the church, who are more concerned about the general welfare and good. And perhaps the word comes more firmly to us to lay these things aside and to love one another. Siblings were the same. So here's my first point. Don't disown your own. Because I don't know about you, but I remember when I first became a Christian, I was driving down the road and I saw this car and it had a fish on the back. And as our car came along parallel, I was so excited. Look, there's some Christians. And so, like a child, I waved. And they looked at me like, perhaps some of you have shaken hands with somebody at church. And then you've gone to the supermarket and seen the same person behind the aisle. Don't disown your own. You have a duty to each other, to acknowledge each other, to recognize each other. It doesn't have to mean that it takes 2.5 hours to get through Tesco's. Just Loving recognition, acknowledgement, and help if needed is our duty as the people of God. I think afterwards, from verse 2 onwards, those next few verses going down to verse 8, let's say, there are some practical outworkings of this love, where love gets tested. So, for example, in verse 2, the strangers. I mean, each one of these verses is a sermon in its own right, but let's take the strangers for a minute. We like to get to know people, don't we? We like to have the time to be able to get the measure of them, their likes, their dislikes, the compatibility. But this passage is saying, don't you dare. They may be a total stranger, but if they're trusting Jesus Christ, you welcome them as your own. So a person should be able to show up first time, first day, acknowledge Jesus Christ in your presence with you, and you should welcome them as brothers and sisters. That is the foundation on which we work. So people should be able to move around and turn up, and we should be able to welcome them as brothers and sisters without some lengthy process of application by which we will sniff around at some long and extended process that may last for several years before we finally agree to let you make the tea. And it should also be irrespective of fortune. Verse 3, the person in prison. That it's nice to be able to associate ourselves with the people who are, we like to associate with people who are doing well. Successful people, prosperous people, clever people, influential people, helpful people. We have a natural tendency to that. But what can we do about the man in prison? The person who has, their fortune has collapsed for whatever reason. Should we say, I know they're a Christian, but I'd be embarrassed to go down there through... Has anybody here been to prison or visited prison? They are not comfortable places. They are steeped in an atmosphere. And the moment you walk down that corridor, you walk into that place, you are associated with that atmosphere. And either you're going to say, well, I don't want to be contaminated. I don't want to. Don't you dare, says this passage. That's your brother. That's your sister. And you stand with your brother or your sister, whether they're on the heights doing well or whether they're at the bottom looking like they're at the bottom of the pile. You visit them. That's your family. That's the people of God. That's what this passage, I think, apart from anything else, is saying. And then verse 4, about marriage. You see, marriage is at least a huge component in marriage is emotion. Let brotherly love continue. Anna, have a seat. Have a seat, Anna. Micah, let Anna go by. Let Anna go by. It's all right. Well done. Good boy. So, let brotherly love continue. Oh, my hearts go out to them, don't they? It's tough. It's tough sometimes. It's tough sometimes. Should we press reset there? On verse 4, I'm talking about marriage. So feelings. I want to talk about feelings in relationship to marriage. At least a significant component in marriage is attraction, which has an important emotional component to it. Some people you are drawn to. Some people, not so much. Some people you are literally, physically attracted to. Some people, not so much. And that's all taking place in the realms of your emotions. It's a very powerful and pervasive experience to fall for somebody or to be drawn to somebody, or likewise to be repulsed by somebody and find somebody really difficult to be around. Now, especially in the days in which you're living, perhaps more so than in former times, there is incredible weight placed on the justifications people give to their feelings. If it feels right, do it. If it feels good, it must be. This passage tells us, don't go there. Don't go there. Our feelings are a gift from God. We thank the Lord, and there's a place for them. God has granted marriage. But outside of that, that is not the place of those emotions. That's not the place of those feelings for the single people. You can't just let your feelings drive and govern you into actions. Oh, I'm not happy in my marriage. And not to diminish that, sorry if I came over that way, forgive me. But there's something more important. Your husband is your brother. Your wife is your sister. That man's wife is your sister. That man's husband is your brother. That young single person, that's your sister. That young single man, that's your brother. That is the ultimate means by which we're to conduct ourselves towards one another. That is the if God grants special license for a man and a woman to enjoy their emotional life in that particular way, then God be glorified. But outside of that, let brotherly and sisterly love continue. In other words, don't go there. Don't go there. And verses 5 and 6 starts talking about money. Because we're economic animals. Money's a part of all of our lives. And there are opportunities. Picture yourself, the salesman, with your rather overpriced and not very dependable Hoover that you're selling around the place. And you come to church and you see all these Christians and you think, ah, a market. Here's all the customers for my wonderful product. Don't go there. Firstly, you shouldn't be selling that thing anyway. Especially not to your brothers. And especially not to your sisters. This is your family. Their prosperity, their financial security, you should be looking out for. You should be making sure that they're doing as well as they possibly can. And if that costs you, then so be it. Is God not able to look after you? Will he not provide for you? Test God, your Father, in this regard, and show brotherly love towards one another, even if it costs you pounds, shillings, and pence. And for the youngsters, that was what we used to have in this country. Lastly, the leaders, verse 7. Some people get a particular status in the life of a church. Usually we trust because they have come to that place through service and gifting and calling. And their way of life, it speaks about in that verse, is very significant and important and instrumental in the life of the church and the governance of the church. And there is a danger that we treat them differently. That we either put them on a pedestal and treat them almost like fathers, or sometimes we put them down on the floor as if they're our doormats. Don't do that. Don't go there. They're your brothers. They're your brothers. They're your... And leaders, likewise, to the congregation, to the church. They aren't... You know, I can honestly tell you, some people struggle with public speaking. And I've heard this advice being given out. When you stand in front of a group of people, imagine that all their heads are cabbages. Because then it takes away the sort of thing of looking at all these different... Don't do that. Then you're not cabbages. Well. You're my brothers. You're my sisters. That's how we're to treat each other. That's how we're to remain. We're never going to get above that. We're never going to go below that. Let's not go below that. We have a duty to love each other, to respect each other, to help each other as best as we're able. Because ultimately, verse 8, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever, we're told. And he acknowledges you, doesn't he? When you're at your lowest, when you've, let's say, God forbid, but let's say you have blown it, you've sinned, and you know it, and you're feeling ashamed and wretched, and you turn to God, and you see Jesus there, does he turn his face away from you? As you turn to him and appeal to him, oh Lord, I've done it again. Through your precious blood, please plead with me for the Father for forgiveness of my sins. I want to go on. I want to continue my walk with you. Will he turn you away? Jesus acknowledges you in the presence of God as his brothers. Chapter 2, verse 11. He is not ashamed to call you brothers. He helps you, doesn't he? Does he help you any time you ask? Every time, any day, day or night, is he there for you? Is there any affection in Jesus Christ? Is there any love? Has anybody here experienced any love from Jesus? Well, then let us also act towards him as his family too. Let's acknowledge Jesus. Let's not be ashamed of Jesus. Let's help in any way we can the work that he's doing in the world. Let's show our love and affection for him in our praying, in our conduct, in our singing, and in our speaking. Simple things. Don't disown your own. Yes? Okay, last and final point. We all know that lots of things can creep in. We all know that other priorities can find their way into our hearts and capture our hearts. And chapter 13, verses 9 through 16 gives an illustration, and it's a very pointed illustration, and I haven't got time to go into it in particular detail, but it focuses on food. Can you see that? On food, sacrificial food in this particular instance. And clearly, what's beginning to happen, or the temptation that this particular group is suffering, is that there are certain dietary laws that are being referred to here, as if somehow one is beginning to show brotherly love to those who practice things in one way, and not to show that same brotherly love towards people who are practicing and doing things in another way. As if the cultural markers that existed, that people are giving excessive status to these things. And it may seem a remote thing to us, but the truth is, there are people with whom you culturally have more in common with. There are people who like the same food as you, who dig the same sounds that you like. Did I actually just say that? I can't believe I used that word. I'm so embarrassed. People who dress the same way that you dress, who think that a certain kind of way of dress is the right way to dress. And they associate themselves with those people because they see themselves as being, that is the right group. This is my group. This is my people based on what I eat, what I don't eat, how I dress, how I don't dress, what I listen to, what I don't listen to, what I like, what I don't like. My friends, this is tribalism growing up. This is the cliques. Tell me churches don't suffer with cliques. Clannishness grows up. And what you have to remember, these people, they are different from you. They are really different from you. But they are your brothers. They are your sisters. And that is how you are to love them. Sit down and have a meal with them. Talk about what they're interested in and what they're like. Share what you have with them. Let brotherly love continue. Do you know what? This is really, really subtle here. I think this borders around the area of friendships. We go to church. I want to go to church to see my friends. I like to go to church and see my friends. And when I get to church, I sit with my friends. And after the service, I have a cup of coffee with my friends. And we understand that. We like to have friends. It's good to have friends. There's some people we get on with better than others. It's natural. But don't go there. There is something more important that God would have you to do. Because thinking of Jesus' teaching, you know, even friends, you know, even the Gentiles, the unbelievers, they're friendly with their friends. This is your family. These different people. People who you don't get on with. That is your brother. That is your sister. Why not sit next to them? Why not have a cup of coffee with them? Why not get to know them? It's your brother. It's your sister. If I'm being repetitive, I'm doing it on purpose. Because this is the final point of this whole book. It's the public, visible, demonstrative witness of the love of Jesus Christ for his people being manifest by his people. So that all can see we're different. God is with us. So how are we going to break free? How are we going to break into this? Because it is a struggle, isn't it? It is a struggle. But according to verse 20 through to 22, there is help in the struggle. There is help in the struggle. All the way through to the end. And if we were to summarize it, now may the God of peace, there is a God who will help you with this. He brought again from the dead our Lord Jesus. He brought Jesus alive. Will he not help you? Can he not help you? Has he no power that he can't help you with this exercise of brotherly love? The great shepherd of the sheep by the blood of the eternal covenant. Are you in this covenant? Are you a Christian? Can you call on God? Will he help you? Will he equip you, verse 22, with everything good that you may do his will? Can he? Will he? Working that which is pleasing in his sight. That's the ultimate thing. We're called to live a life that pleases God. And that may mean, in truth, not pleasing yourselves. Through Jesus Christ, to whom be glory forever and ever. Amen. And then this final appeals in the last 20, from verse 22 onwards. And of course, the final conclusion, the great need that we have, the great need the church has, every Christian has, verse 25, grace. Grace be with all of you. All of you. Final thing to say. It's most unusual. Really, really unusual. Verse 24. Just notice one thing. Greet all your leaders and all the saints. Greet all your leaders. I think this is quite unusual, if not unique, in terms of this book is written to, as it were, it's not written to leaders. Do you see the point? The people it's been written to are told to greet their leaders. That's quite unusual. As if this is a quiet word in the ear of the believer, the ordinary believer, how they should live out their life. This isn't. Sometimes it's kind of hard, isn't it, for a leader to tell the people, you know, you need to love me more. But this letter kind of comes directly to the believer. It bypasses the leaders. It comes directly to the believer and says to them, look, just live out your life like this. Live your life like this. Live it openly. Come to church. Be there every Sunday. Go to the prayer meetings. Turn up. When you see a fellow Christian in the street, say hi. Respect each other's marriages. You know, and then the leaders, just can imagine what the net benefits are going to be to the leaders. You know, we can be friends, not needing to be managed. You don't want pastors to be managers, do you? It says, you know, it'd be burdensome. You don't want it to be burdensome upon leaders, do you, to run a church? It's like, oh, I'm pulling my hair out. I've got all these Christians. God forbid. When brotherly love's there, it's a joy. We can do things. We can get out there. We can go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. Let brotherly love continue. Don't disown your own. Should we sing something?